Hello, this is Claire Levy. Coming up in this edition of the DRWF podcast, Living with Diabetes, we have the latest instalment of our special series of programmes looking specifically at women's health. In this episode, I've been talking to Sajila Kershi, who is living with type 2 diabetes and wants to raise awareness in her South Asian community. She attempts to manage her condition alongside a challenging lifestyle on the road as a comedian.
Well, initially I was told I was pre-diabetic. And I, in all honesty, and it sounds ignorant, but I didn't know what that meant. And he said, you're going to have to use metformin, which I did know what that was. And I said, oh no, but I don't really want to. And I really felt absolutely awful. You know, when I first got diagnosed, my mum, she was just like, oh, you know, so-and-so in our family, he had it in, and his leg was amputated and your grandfather's jaw was amputated and, you know, and so-and-so, they died and so-and-so, they died too as well. So, you know, look after yourself. And I'm like, yeah, cheery thoughts, mum. Thanks a lot, love. Thanks a lot for that, because now that's all I've got to look forward to. So it could, at that point, I suppose I did feel like, oh my God, that's it, my life's over. I don't see this as a terrible thing. This is an opportunity because I've been given a kick up the backside. Like, life isn't just all hee hee ha ha and you just waltz through it. Things can go wrong. I think women generally are not good at speaking out about health stuff. Not because they don't want to, because they just feel like you just got to get on with it. Or certainly my generation.
Hear the full interview coming up next.
Views, information, or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent the opinions, standards, or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them. The aim of podcasts is to educate and inform, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. Neither DRWF nor any of its employees or owners shall be held liable or responsible for the accuracy or completeness for any errors or omissions in podcasts or for any damage you may suffer as a result of failing to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who is familiar with your situation.
Welcome to Sajila Kershi.
Hello.
An empowering woman and hilarious comedian.
No, yes. Who's been saying these things?
She found fame with her politically fueled show, Immigrant Diaries. So, welcome, Sajila. Lovely to have you on our podcast.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Can you give us a bit more of an introduction about yourself and your life and where you are and what you're doing now?
Well, I am a South Asian, so first generation South Asian, and I'm, as you said, a comedian, I'm a writer. I have type 2 diabetes, for full disclosure, for this particular podcast, and I've been living with it for several years now, about 2013, I would say. Am I a good example of, I don't know, this is like, people do good, you know, there's good diabetics or bad diabetics, I don't know where I fall into that, but I'm trying to kind of navigate through it, and I feel quite strongly about my community, South Asian community, kind of being a little bit more aware, I guess, as well as myself. I'm teaching myself too, yeah, so that's why I'm here, to try and tell you all that.
So what was your reaction when you were diagnosed? Were you expecting it? Was it a shock?
Well, initially, I was told I was pre-diabetic. And in all honesty, and it sounds ignorant, but I didn't know what that meant. Yes, I know we have Google, but I didn't think to kind of really look at that. I thought, pre-diabetic. And he said, you're going to have to use metformin, which I did know what that was. And I said, oh, no, but I don't really want to. And I really felt absolutely awful. I was really feeling like crap. And I said, I'll manage it myself. But I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't know, you know, I had a very unhealthy lifestyle. I was like gigging like four or five times a week. So that's like late nights. I can't eat before a performance because, you know, your adrenaline's high, so I'd be eating late at night. It was all the wrong things. I was doing, you know, the Ginster's diet, if you like, and service stations. And I obviously didn't succeed in what I now realise you can actually reverse it at that point. And I didn't succeed. So, of course, I went on metformin and then all the other things happen, which is like the underactive thyroid. So I take thyroxine, high cholesterol, so I'm on statins, and the list just goes on and on. One thing goes wrong. Look after your buddies out there because they only get one. So here I am now. Would I say I'm any wiser than when I first got diagnosed? Yes, I am. Is it easy to maintain? I do struggle like everybody else probably does. There's good days and bad days. Sometimes I can feel very heavenly and, you know, halo around my head and think, gosh, I am so good at this. I'm so good at diabetes. And other times I'm just like, okay, I'll really fail the taste now. So yeah, it's up and down.
So your family, you say your South Asian background, there's more propensity.
Yes.
Type 2 diabetes.
Yes. So I've got a family riddled with diabetes, and it's almost like, a badge of honour or dishonour, I don't know. They just find out they've got sugar. That's how they describe it, like sugar. And so it doesn't sound harmful, does it? Just a bit of sugar. So they've got it. So we know, and it's, you know, everybody in our family who's had diabetes, they think they've died of diabetes, but it's actually been diabetes has been the first diagnosis, and then of course it'll be heart attacks, which is, you know, a major killer. But even despite that, it's not openly talked about that this is a killer. It can be a killer disease if we don't watch it. When I first got diagnosed, my mum, she was just like, oh, you know, so-and-so in our family, he had it in, and his leg was amputated, and your grandfather's toe was amputated, and, you know, and so-and-so, they died, and so-and-so, they died too as well. So, look after yourself. And I'm like, yeah, cheery thoughts, Mum. Thanks a lot, love. Thanks a lot for that, because now that's all I've got to look forward to. So at that point, I suppose I did feel like, oh, my God, that's it. My life's over, if I'm honest. Yeah, I did feel that. But not now. Now I kind of gone the opposite. Where like I can still do anything I want to do. There's nothing stopping me from doing the things I want. But yeah, and it's, I'd say that in my family it's still misunderstood. It's not even with me. I don't think they really understand that I need to eat when I need to eat. You know, and I've got to take my meds at a particular time, so I'll keep a very specific routine. And they don't, you know, seem to get it. And it's frustrating, but it's only when you get it, then you realise, because when I got it, I just, my grand aunt, who I used to visit a lot, and I was like, oh my God, she used to be waiting for us, like we'd be late, and you know, she wouldn't get to eat on time, that means that she hadn't taken her medication on time. So yeah, I think knowledge should not be gained just when you get the disease, it should be there in our communities.
And how do you start those conversations then, within a community that's not particularly engaged?
I think, unfortunately, the South Asian community are not good at addressing a lot of things. There's so much stigma, you know, whether it's breast cancer, testicular cancer, whether it's, the menopause, you know, even starting your periods is a huge thing. It's getting better, you know, with my generations, I guess, and the new generation, they're completely opposite because they're so much into their well-being. It's a complete opposite from where I was brought up. But I do think conversations need to happen. And we talked off air about cookery programs, you know, and it was like, it's got to go from where they would start the cooking process, which is going to their supermarkets and picking up the rice, would you know that if you use rice, you could, if you froze it and then you defrosted it, that would make it better. You know, chana dal, it's much better for you. And, you know, there's all these different things that we use in our cooking that could... But is that going to work? I don't know until we try. I certainly think that we're lagging behind in terms of, you know, having that conversation.
Do you need more South Asian voices helping?
100%.
Yeah, because I think sometimes the white person, they're not going to kind of parachute in and suddenly solve all these problems, are they?
No, and sometimes I wonder if they think there's white privilege in even diseases. Oh, well, you see, white diabetes is different. It's more privileged. You know, I don't know. I don't know how this is viewed, but maybe there is an element of that, you know, that we have it differently. You know, we have it differently. Also, can I just say, the South Asian community, we're all doctors. We're all doctors. Even me, you know, my uncle who studied, like, for years and years, he'll say, look, you need to cut back on the carbs because that doesn't help your diabetes. And then my other aunt was going, what do you know? I know you can eat as much roti and as much rice as you want. You're talking rubbish. It's very good for you. My grandmother had it. Yeah, but your grandmother also had diabetes, you know. And it's everybody's a doctor, so everybody's self-diagnosing. And I feel like we've got that in the West anyway, since we've got Google. All you have to do is just Google something, and you know, that's it. You think you've got it sussed. But conversations need to be happening with professionals, with people in our communities, I think.
And where are those people, do you think, in the community? Where do you get to them? Where are they meeting? What would be a good way?
Well, it's an underground network, obviously. No, I'm joking. No, I don't know where they are. I think they're amongst us. They're everywhere. I feel, I don't know how we get to, my guess is with any awareness, you know, like you've got to start talking in kind of small groups, you know, and then getting that message to go out there. I know that even in my family, my brother-in-law's got some health issues, and we were at my sister's at the weekend, and we started talking about, you know, the rice thing, like the freezing the rice, and my brother started debating, goes, oh, I think you can, because he doesn't really like to freeze the rice because it feels like it's a long wait for him to get to eat that rice. Because I think you just have to cool it down, and then we were arguing. I said, no, it's frozen. And so, you know, even that is a conversation that's going back and forth, which means they would have, no doubt, after that conversation, both gone and Googled both sides to see what's what. But it starts that conversation happening. What was happening before, it was just like, give me water, get my water, son, I need to take my medication. And that was the older generation. I mean, maybe the younger ones would have just done it quietly, you know, without, sort of discreetly. But certainly any talk, I think, is good to try and move the conversation forward.
And you've talked about not eating before a performance and then eating late and possibly not even the right things. Do you think also, the adrenaline, you're talking about stress, you know, how does that all affect your diabetes? So you're really hyped up before you go on stage, so your stress levels are possibly quite high, your cortisol levels are quite high.
Yeah, cortisol, that's a great Instagram buzzword, isn't it, cortisol? Definitely it took its toll, you know, because even if I had eaten, that doesn't, or taken my medications, I've done all the right things, that doesn't stop me from then feeling a little bit lightheaded and blurry-eyed on stage, or, you know, just after I've come off stage, there's that slump. Or what would happen is I may get home like 2 o'clock in the morning, and because your adrenaline is so high, you need to come down from that. So, I mean, you know, I did get addicted to telenovelas, you know, kind of drug lord telenovelas, which is, I don't know if that's good for the diabetes, but it certainly made you have that come down. But it's definitely affected me in terms of not being able to gig as much as I want. So I choose the work that I do now, whereas before, and I think initially I tried to carry on as normal, but it affects your body. It definitely makes a difference, even if you're doing all the right things, because you can't control the cortisol, you can't control the adrenaline. Certainly I should take a Red Bull before. I know, until my doctor said, you are going to get a heart attack, you know. And then I thought, I'll go on to Coca-Cola, you know. And now I'm fine, I'm just going to do with water, because I always felt I needed something but I'm already fired up. You know, even doing something like this, a podcast, it's, you know, there's a version of you that's sort of always on air or always on performance.
Yeah.
And that takes a different energy than just sitting down.
Yeah. But you have said that your diagnosis led to your greatest success.
Yeah.
diagnosis comes not with just diabetes, but other conditions. How has this affected that work-life balance then?
So when I got diagnosed, I initially it wasn't great, and then other things came, and then I think I started losing my hearing quite rapidly, and I got vertigo as a result of that, which I've got balance problems. And I've always been kind of a half glass full kind of person, which is very difficult than when I actually have a mental health issues, because I'm just like, I'm crying through the, but it's still okay, sort of a bit of Pollyanna kind of vibes, but like mass, like, you know, upset inside. And I thought, this is actually an opportunity. I don't see this as a terrible thing. This is an opportunity, because I've been given a kick up the backside. Like, life isn't just all hee hee ha ha and you just like just waltz through it. Things can go wrong, and you know, I'm gonna, where I was like calling it in and perhaps not pushing myself as much as I did before, which is strange given that I just said all the things about gigging and how it affects you. I was pushing a lot harder and really, really like making the work I was doing count, which is then obviously that led to the awards, you know, got Asian Woman of Achievement in the Arts and Culture, you know, for my show Immigrant Diaries, that like got, you know, really great praise and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So everything I then touched was with intention, you know, it wasn't like, well, I've got all the time in the world so I could just smelly around or whatever. It was, this is important to me, this really matters to me, and I'm going to make it work, not to get the accolades kind of happened as a, you know, kind of an aside, but it was because I was truly doing stuff that I wanted to do. So the little, you know, the 20-minute set in a rough club in Essex, which, you know, were full of stags, I didn't really like doing that anyway. You know, I was like, this is just shoveling poop uphill. I could now choose what I wanted to do, and that work made it condensed down. So actually I was doing better work because of it. So that's what I meant about the success, is that it made me feel like, you know, superpower. Yeah.
So how does comedy help, do you think, dealing with difficult subjects, maybe health issues? How do you kind of flip that or use it as material to sort of really get underneath and help people?
So without any intention to do so, I've kind of got a bit of a reputation for having slightly, like, kind of like on the nose kind of material maybe sometimes, but it's really I've always talked about things that matter to me, and that can be politics, and that can be religion, and that can be, you know, it's usually the personal prism of my own journey. So I'm never afraid of tackling anything, you know, so awful. Have I talked about diabetes? I haven't, because there is a rule in comedy, which is tragedy plus time equals comedy. Now, the tragedy it's gone long gone, you know, the diagnosis and the upset of that, that's all long gone. I'm just living with this condition, but I don't feel that that doesn't define me necessarily. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it's just, you know, I don't wake up in the morning, hey, I'm a diabetic, and what kind of day? And you've also got an underactive thyroid, don't forget that, Sajila. And then, of course, like, we're here, hey, and we can't hear, okay, honey, we can't hear, so you've got no ears, so don't forget about that. And, oh my God, you're going to need a support bra because you're, like, over middle age, you know, you went through the menopause, you remember that? You know, so none of this is happening. It's just you get up and you've got to do, and you don't consider it. And, you know, like I say, with terms of medication, I have, how I've tried to make it sort of tighter for me is this regimented routine, like, you know, between midday and 1 o'clock, I will eat and I will take my meds in that, you know, and then I'll take my meds at this point. And it helps. I've got a little pill box thing. So I've forgotten the original question because I also have brain fog.
The original question was, how does comedy help?
Okay. So comedy helps because when you laugh, when you make someone laugh, it's something that you can't control. And that's why there's a lot of misogynists out there who say, oh, I don't find women funny. And then when they do laugh, when a woman makes them laugh, they get a bit irritated, right? And I know those stag dudes. But it's because it can make you think, and a comedy is best for me when you've made them laugh, but they leave the room and the work happens after they've left the room. And that's what used to happen with Immigrant Diaries, which was like, you know, we're talking about migrants, which is such a, you know, still a very thorny subject. And it's you've made you laugh and then you leave and the discussion is happening in your head. Oh, okay. So they came here because they wanted a better life, or they wanted this, and they, well, that's no different to my family, blah, 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 you know. And I think that's with any subject. And actually, going back to your earlier question about how do we reach our communities, humour is the one thing, humour and dance, actually two things, that actually connect the whole world, irrespective if you speak the language or not, because you can do slapstick, you can do, you know, there's ways, we all laugh. We laugh involuntarily, we laugh at silly things, and we all can dance, whether you think you're a good dancer or a bad dancer. But they're things that connect us. And I think humour is absolutely key. So my work has transformed from going on the stage to just like people who want to have a laugh, you know, on a Friday night, to, you know, working with charities, to working with causes that are important to me. So Immigrant Diaries was about trying to get people aware about, you know, these faceless people. They're real. And of course, today I'm hoping that to some lesser or more extent, just thinking, well, actually, you know, South Asian communities specifically, there is humour there. There is. I know it's hard to believe, but there is. It's usually happening in the kitchen with all the mums and stuff. But why can't we use humour to reach them and teach them about these things?
Because I think what I was told was that, you know, Asian men are less likely to talk about their health.
Yeah.
They'll talk about anything else, but not because it's seen as less than manly or weaker. Or so how do you get over those kind of...
We've got to teach them about man flu then. It's like, if we taught them about the Western man flu, then they would finally talk about their health like Western men do, right? So that's what we've got to do, is just teach them about man flu.
Okay. I'll leave that one with you then. What about your counselling skills? You talked about using that in your stand-up. Does that translate when you're talking like about something like living with type 2 diabetes?
I think with people who are uncomfortable talking about it, does it help me? No, because you can't counsel yourself. But you can, I suppose. But, you know, I think someone's feeling a bit uncomfortable. I can pick those things up. Same as like in a reading a room and, you know, in a comedy room, you know, I know, like I mentioned Stags earlier, I know which one to go for in that group, and it's the one that needs to be brought down. And if I bring that person down, but it's a different with this group of women. A group of women is so much harder because there's a sisterhood. So if you attack any one of those, they'll be like, you know, especially junk women, come on, we've all been there, girls. You know, it's like, you leave my mate alone, you know, you leave her alone. If she's... But yeah, so I think it's about understanding how and who to reach out to the group. So maybe going back to your, you know, I'm going to keep coming because I am South Asian, is that we've got to talk to the right people? I don't know. Reach out to the right people. Because, yeah, obviously, you know, my internal desire is always to make people happy, like through laughter. But it's also to give them a space to speak as well, you know, and understanding where I can't push it too much. It's like anyone like in a you know, hey, where are you from? And they might not give you something for the first couple of lines, and you know now to not go there, you know, because they can't give you any more than that. So, okay, and, you know, sometimes you get it wrong, but over the years you get to know which one you can go to who's going to be more open to speak to it. But how do you reach that person who doesn't want to engage? They've got their arms crossed, you know. So you just let them hear the conversation elsewhere, you know, the comedy's going elsewhere. Oh, they just cracked a smile there. That's something that relates to them, you know. So I suppose it's the same as comedy and counselling are almost, can be synonymously sort of same if you, especially when I'm emceeing a lot, you know, because you can see where you can push, where you can't. Ah, oh, that's what they're interested in. You know, you can see that. So I guess it's the same thing would happen with diabetes.
So are you keen to discuss health inequalities and maybe within the community you're from?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I know, again, we've had conversations about women just generally. And I think if we can sort of focus on that, that women universally are kind of almost taught from an early age just to get on with it. You know, say what, you started your period, get on with it, here's your pads, go and deal with it. You know, oh, you've had a baby. You're not the first person to have a baby. Come on, you can do this, but it's fine. You know, oh, menopause, yeah, well, it happens to all of us, perimenopause. Well, you know, I only got my head around menopause and then somebody told me there was a trainee menopause, which is the perimenopause, you know. So, but, you know, we're just told to get on with it. And you add to that health issues. I mean, you talked about South Asian men not speaking out about their health. I think women generally are not good at speaking out about health stuff. Not because they don't want to, because they just feel like it's, you just got to get on with it. Mm. Or certainly my generation.
Mm. What about the healthcare professionals then that you're visiting, the GPs? Are they dealing with this in a good way?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we all know the NHS is in a dire situation. And I have like a, you know, an eye screening every year. And I was just told, literally had my 1 year, you know, diabetes checkup yesterday. And I was told that I would only have that screening every 2 years now. And I was like, okay. I used to have like regular B12 jabs. And suddenly, miraculously, apparently, it's, you know, within acceptable reach, you know, but I can feel that I'm different. I think there's just cuts, unfortunately, behind the scenes. That's what's happening, is cuts. And I don't know if that is also a bit of ageism, because it's like you get to a certain age and they're thinking, well, you know, you kind of, we've done all we can. It's this is as much as you're going to get from us, and everyone's got to get an equal kind of share in that NHS kind of care, I guess. But in terms of like diabetes, how helpful were they? Again, I think you're kind of pretty much left to your own devices. It's not like, I feel like when I was a kid, the GP would call you if there was an issue, like, what, how is this going now? We just don't have that luxury anymore. You know, I went to my GP and she said, we've got 10 minutes. Which one do you want to talk about? Which issue? Because I can't do both. And that's not her being cruel. That's just the reality of the NHS at the moment.
But it leaves you feeling a bit abandoned.
It leaves me feeling like, again, going back to that, reinforcing that inner core belief that I'm just being a burden. I'm just, you know, I just got to get on with it. Just, you know, just push it down. It's not relevant to anyone else apart from me.
So what about signposting? Do you think the community groups need to do more signposting, more intelligence gathering to work with people for all sorts of conditions, but certainly diabetes?
I don't know if signposting works, if I'm honest, in that group. I don't think, even I don't, yeah, the reality is I don't use it. So how could I expect someone else to use something that I know I can kind of turn a blind eye to?
Mm. So come on, I'm going to challenge you with, not necessarily now, but at some time in the future, working with us about getting more information out there and usable information that people will actually pay attention to.
I still believe in humour. I believe in performance, because if you're watching something, you know, make a Bollywood film where every character's, you know, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, and then suddenly they're just like, you know, oh, just let me just check my, oh, the levels are fine. Can we have a fight later on, please? I don't know. I think entertainment, generally speaking, makes me think about things. And we're so content. I mean, but we're talking about the younger generation, because the older generation, you know, again, with generational, I think both East and West will have differences. Where I was saying that our generations kind of just get on with it. The new generation, you know, the Gen Zs or Gen X, where are they? The new ones. they're you know, they're all about the well-being. They'll tell you all, everything that's going on with them. But with the South Asian community, I do think an entertainment, some sort, we've talked about cookery programs possibly, but something they can maybe passively watch and get the message, advertising directed towards them. I honestly don't have an answer, but I'd love to sit down and explore possibilities. Definitely. It's definitely something I would go for.
And is there anything else you want to bring up that we haven't talked about?
What about the diabetes with my cat?
Yeah, well, people do. They tell you, my cat's got diabetes. Yes,
yeah, diabetes with a cat. Is that a thing? Do cats?
Cats get diabetes. Yeah, and you have to inject them.
Do diabetics own diabetic cats?
Oh, well, there's a conundrum. Yes. I don't know the answer to that
one. What came first, the diabetic cat or the diabetic human?
But it is one of those things, isn't it, as you say, within your community. Oh, yes, so-and-so had it, and then they had the leg chopped off. But there's always somebody that they know that's had, or you are eating in a public place, and they'll just look at you and say...
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, can I just tell you about the shaming? The shaming is horrendous. And it, you know, I've been on a video in an Asian wedding, and I just like literally at that moment like got some chicken, you know, from the buffet, and the cameraman will come around, and the three aunties will come over and goes, "Oh, Sajila, is that you? Oh my God! Listen, come here, Jamila, come here. Do you remember Sajila? She used to be so young and pretty and thin. I don't know what happened to her, right?" And then literally the cameraman's getting you like, you know, and they'll look at me like eating the. It's like I haven't eaten anything all day, but there's just the assumption that, you know, it's because you've eaten so much that that's why you must be. But actually, even in media, when I've done like interviews and stuff, we've touched on diabetes. There is an element of, you know, blame and shame. You know, it's like, well, obviously they're not educated enough to know that they should be exercising, they should be doing this. And it's quite baffling because it's like you can't, there isn't enough time because you've got to talk in sound bites to explain, look, actually it's not really, that's not how it works, or, you know, but diabetes is seen as your own fault, which is, you know, frustrating.
It is. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll no doubt pick up on these ideas again in the future, I think.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, the DRWF podcast. And our special series looking at some of the challenges facing women living with diabetes. You can find helpful guidance on all aspects of diabetes, together with details on how to support the charity, fundraising events, news and information on our website at drwf.org.uk. Thanks to all our guests who have helped us explore diabetes and women's health, and to you for joining us. Coming up next time, Laura Spence, a midwife with ADHD, who wants to improve the experience of pregnancy, birth and early parenthood for neurodivergent people.
Yeah. So I mean, with the first two children, there's quite a big age gap between the first two, 5.5 years. I had lost a bit of weight between baby number two and then this pregnancy. And I remember one of my midwife colleagues actually saying I looked like a snake that swallowed a watermelon. It was recommended that I was induced at 39 weeks, although I actually was able to very quickly manage the diabetes. I wasn't medicated for it at the time. I was just checking my blood sugars, you know, multiple times a day after food, before food. Knowing what the risk factors are, that if I don't get this under control, then potentially I'm putting my baby at risk now, was quite terrifying. Because I have looked after families before who sadly, maybe mum had uncontrolled diabetes and sadly have lost babies because of it. So I think when you hold that in the back of your mind, that's that added anxiety. And sometimes I think when you have too much knowledge around the subject, then that's, you know, there's added anxiety that comes with that.
This podcast has been supported by Abbott, Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora media production for DRWF. Copyright 2025. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.